Well, welcome to the latest session of On the Couch. My name is Henry Jennings and I am with Marcus today. And today I'm delighted to be joined by a mining expert, a mining CEO and MD from Xanadu Mines, Colin Moorhead. So I'm really delighted to be bringing you this podcast. I first saw Xanadu present back in London in November, and it really stoked my interest in terms of a copper play in an interesting area. So it's really good that Colin has agreed to come on the show today and we can talk about what's happening with Xanadu, what's happening with copper, and some of those far-flung places that miners have to go to. So welcome, Colin. Thank you very much for coming on.
G'day, Henry. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, just before we kick off, Colin is an experienced industry executive, demonstrated track record of over three decades. You don't look old enough to have done three decades, Colin, I have to say. Building value in mining companies, a geologist by training, and relevant experience as CFO of emerging Indonesian listing producer PT Merdeka Copper Gold, and you're a fellow of the Chartered Professional and past president of AusIMM. So pretty impressive credentials, Colin. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, just before we kick off, as always, there's the disclaimer. It is general advice only, so please do your own research. Contact your own financial advisor regarding any of the thoughts, ideas, or insights in this podcast. All right, Colin. Well, first of all, let's ask the big question, shall we? Copper. Why copper?
Copper is just a basic building block of economic growth. You know, it's necessary to transmit electricity and everything that goes with it. So whilst some commodities may come and go, copper's here for the long run. If you factor in normal growth, there's not enough copper in the supply line to fill requirements. If you put decarbonisation on top of that, then there's definitely a structural deficit in copper coming towards us, and we're already seeing momentum in the copper price, and you know, many are predicting a super cycle with respect to copper.
It's funny, isn't it? Because for a lot of last year, certainly for the last sort of 6 months of last year, I heard lots and lots of talk, and that was something that came up in November, of the copper super cycle, the fact that there wasn't enough supply coming on stream, no one had really invested enough money in production and new projects, and yet the copper price really didn't do an awful lot. And then suddenly, in the last month or so, it's really galvanized people's attention and really kicked higher. Is there any specific reason you see for that, or just people finally woken up to the potential in the copper market?
Well, I think it's a two-level thing. You know, there's softness in the Chinese economy sort of put a lid on copper prices in the short term. But in the long term, there's absolutely no doubt that, you know, it takes probably 20 to 25 years these days to get a decent copper project off the ground. And a lot of the big projects are facing serious barriers and hurdles. We've seen problems in Panama. We've seen problems with the big resolution copper project in Arizona. It's not simple to get a big copper project off the ground, and that's just a fact of the matter as it is. So. The big traditional sources of copper are depleting. Those big mines need to either go underground or be replaced. You know, there's not a lot of advanced projects that are ready to go. Fortunately, Xanadu is one of them. And you know, most of the copper in the world comes from big porphyry deposits or Zambia-style sediment-hosted projects. And, you know, the monsters are, you know, you can count copper mines that do over 400,000 tonnes per annum on one hand.
Yeah, so this brings us to Mongolia, I guess, and Xanadu. Why Mongolia? What are the attractions there? Obviously, that you've got some big players up there already. Was that the attraction for you guys to head up there?
Sure. The Central Asian orogenic belts run east-west through China, Mongolia, and into the Stans. And it's elephant country. Some of the biggest deposits in the world are in those volcanic belts. Compared to the rest of the world, relatively underexplored, and primarily because most of those countries were behind the Iron Curtain for most of the 20th century. Mongolia has been a democracy for 30 years now. They've had some missteps, but they are an emerging economy. great rocks underexplored, and importantly, wide open spaces. The ESG barriers that add to that, 20 to 25 years to get a copper mine up are relatively low in Mongolia, and that's not because their standards are low, it's because the complexity is low. The social complexity is low because there's not many people in the South Gobi Desert, and the topography is very flat and stable, so we're not trying to hang a tailings dam off the side of a mountain in Ecuador.
Does that increase, I guess, the sovereign risk operating in somewhere like Mongolia? We've seen over the years, Rio has had certain hurdles to jump through and certain issues up there with Oyu Tolgoi. Is Mongolia an easy place to do business with? I know, obviously, ESG is probably less red tape there, but is it an easy place to do business?
Well, there's plenty of red tape. It's just a former Soviet sort of... so you still got to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. As far as their fiscal policies go and their mining policies go, it has been difficult, and it goes with the territory, really, when you go into a new postcode. So it's definitely an emerging economy, but it's also an economy that's very heavily dependent on mining. Mining's a big part of their GDP. It's a huge employer, and credit, the training and education in Mongolia is very good, so Mongolian people are all really keen to sort of get ahead. You can be in Australia and there's conversations about royalties and taxes and economic rent. And that's also the case in Mongolia, but I think they've recognised as a country they need to have the conditions to attract foreign direct investment, and they're working towards that.
That's good to know. Now, let's get specific, shall we? Let's talk about Xanadu Mines, which is your project up there. Tell me about Xanadu and what you're trying to do up there.
Sure. Well, we're an exploration company founded by a local guy, Gambaya Lingrisharan, who's been the necessary bloke you need to have in any jurisdiction, who knows everyone and helps us, stay away from bear traps. And Andy Stewart, who's our VP Exploration, who was exploring in Mongolia when he was wearing short pants working for Robert Friedland. So we've got a long history in Mongolia. We're very much an exploration company, looking to build a portfolio of early stage through to more advanced exploration projects. We think we've got the strategic advantage of knowing how to operate safely and efficiently in Mongolia, and we know the rocks really well. So we've got currently got three projects, two very early stage ones, and one quite advanced project in the Hamagtai Porphyry Copper Project.
Maybe we should talk about Kamagtai. That's obviously the right pronunciation, because you know and I don't. But Kamagtai, tell us about that one. That's a 50-50 JV, is that right?
Yeah, it is. So Hamagtai is a very similar sort of geology to Oyu Tolgoi, Rio's big project down the road. They were both former Turquoise Hill projects. And when everybody got all excited about OT, Hamagtai was on the back burner for a while and came to our company in 2014. It's a big porphyry intrusive complex. It's got 1.3 billion tonne resource containing 3.5 million tonnes of copper and 8.5 million ounces of gold. And any junior company that's got a really big project just sort of got the tiger by the tail and requires careful strategy to realise maximum value for the shareholders, and that's really the journey we've been on. So the strategy was, get a resource locked away, do a scoping study or a PEA in Canadian terminology, and then use that to attract a funding partner, because the way for a junior to get maximum leverage for their shareholders is to get a big brother in to help you build these types of mines. So we were able to do a deal with Zijin, one of the fastest growing metals producers in the world. I think they're close to 1 million tonnes of copper last year and are heading towards 3 million ounces of gold. They're in 16 different countries around the world now and one of the most rapidly growing companies in the world, and they're a very sophisticated, capable company. They're also Chinese, which helps because you know, Mongolia is a landlocked country. Nothing can go out through Russia at the moment. So any product produced in Mongolia is going to go to China. And having a Chinese partner certainly doesn't hurt in terms of, you know, getting your commodity to market efficiently.
I guess there's a, you know, you've got a market cap of 120 million or whatever it is currently when we go to air. Is there a massive danger, and you alluded to this, that you are going to get stitched up by somebody, and that leverage to the project kind of gets diluted away over time? Is that must be a tricky balancing act for you guys to really maximise shareholder returns whilst getting the project going. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I think we dealt with that one in the JV structure. So Zijin came in at the Lisco level with a placement at a premium to market cap, at a premium to the share price, and took 19.9% of the company. That required Australian Foreign Investment Review Board approval, which they were able to attain. So there's no issues with that. So they sit as our biggest shareholder at the Lisco level. We also formed a JV at the holding company level, which is the 50-50 JV you referred to. The holding company controls the project, so it's all about control. Currently, we share control. They don't have control without our consent, and vice versa. So at some stage, you know, to take this project forward, you know, there needs to be a control discussion. At the moment, we share that. Our side of that bargain was to invest that $35 million in a pre-feasibility study and de-risk the project in terms of technical risk and permitting and approvals risk, to the point where, you know, we've got a single go forward case and an ore reserve and that meets certain criteria, and we're on track to deliver that in September. At September, operatorship of the JV goes to Zijin.
Right.
However, you know, any budget approvals and what have you still require, you know, a 50-50 agreement. So they can't just decide to dilute us unless we decide to be diluted. We did protect ourselves on the downside with a put option. We have the ability to put half of our half, which would cede control to them, for $25 million. And then be loan carried on agreed terms right through production. So we would end up with a long-term beneficial ownership of something like 20% of the project going forward.
Right.
Yeah, so that's just your sort of your safety net. Yeah. I would hope that, you know, our other options are, you know, for us to go and fund our own half. You know, that can be done. But it's not really our preference, or to do some sort of other deal with Zijin to take the project forward.
So you've recently appointed Bacchus to as an advisor role. That's obviously part of that, giving you some optionality in terms of equity funding, debt funding. Perhaps is that the way of the future?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, we need to investigate all of our options and make sure that Zijin's aware of all of our options, and use that optionality to negotiate the best terms we can for our shareholders to take this project forward.
And is it hard dealing with the Chinese? I mean, there seems to be angst amongst, you know, nations, you know, Australia and China from time to time, but that seems to be cooling down a little bit, thawing. Are they easy to deal with?
Oh, listen, I don't think easy is the word. I've found Zijin to be, you know, reputationally, they're the most Western of Chinese companies.
Right.
You know, they're my opposite number in that their BD guy is based in Toronto and is a long-term Canadian and very, very sort of Western in the way he deals with you know, M&A type discussions.
Right.
Their technical people in Xiamen in China are very good. I've visited their research facilities and their engineering facilities. And, you know, they're in JV with Ivanhoe over in Africa, and they've built mines all over the world. And so they're quite pragmatic in that respect. They are a big company, so they can be a little bit bureaucratic.
Yeah.
But I've found them to be very honourable in terms of, you know, the deal's a deal, and they'll do their bit, we'll do our bit, and to their credit, they've been good. We did do something smart, though. We pre-agreed the budget scope and schedule for the PFS
right.
as part of the JV agreement. So we haven't had any blues about that sort of stuff. And you know, they've got a guy in the project as deputy general manager. He's a good guy. He's working on power and water for us. There's a JV committee, which is two and two, which I chair, and that's been a good process. And they have a board member at our top level. So there's been good integration at all levels with Sagina, and I've found them to be pretty straight bat when it comes to.
So we're waiting this year the PFS. That's going to be the big moment, I guess, for you guys, and maybe some changes to the scoping study. Is that on the cards?
Yeah. We're certainly looking to generate something as good or better than the scoping study. The scoping study was deliberately conservative in nature. There was no technical courage in that. It was a truck and shovel open pit operation feeding a conventional concentrator with conventional tailings and all the rest of it. So nothing sort of out there and courageous in that. What we've looked at to improve that in terms of the oxide material that sits on top of each of our deposits is considered in the scoping study to be waste. We've been doing leach test work on that to see if we can whack it through a crusher and create some value in a heap leach, which would turn that liability, 55 million tonnes at $2 a tonne pre-strip, you know, $100 million liability into an asset. And that's been positive and would happen early in the project. We've also, in terms of sulphide, all the test work's coming back pretty much in line with what the PEA anticipated. Very nice, clean concentrate, some nice gold recovery, gravity recovery gold up front. Nice, clean con, which everybody's going to want. Coarse particle flotation looks positive for us, which all the big copper guys do, which means, yeah, running a coarse grind and recovering most of your copper for a smaller mass pool, and then putting all your energy into a smaller amount of tons, so it's a sort of a throughput recovery trade-off. That looks like it's got positive outcomes for us. Now we're also looking to electrify our haulage later in the project. With trolley assist, our pits are configured in a way that you can sort of run electric over diesel initially. And the OEMs are telling us that they're designing the trucks now so that eventually that diesel engine can be replaced with a battery.
Right.
And you can try. So future-proofing the fleet, if you like. Mining is a major cost driver, so is a major emitter of carbon. So if you can, kill two birds with one stone, why wouldn't you?
Exactly. Now, Colin, whenever we talk to whenever anyone considers mining, grade is king. What sort of grades are there up in your main project in Mongolia, Kamagtai?
Because it's such a big system, it's a relatively low-grade system when you look at the average grade, which is, as I say to people, a terrible way to look at porphyries. We have a large pit, White Hill, which is a big low-grade pit, which is grist for the mill, if you like, and that comes in the back end of our project. We have a higher-grade pit called Stockwork Hill, which is slightly higher stripping ratio, but has... we have 125 million tonnes at nearly 1% copper equivalent in our system, which we treat early. So our current strategy is a stage one where we focus on grade and then pivot to a throughput strategy later on by doubling up the process throughput rate and maintaining your production levels with throughput. Now, everybody does this in the porphyry world, so I would say that be careful about comparing porphyry projects by average grade, because it's a terrible way to do it.
Right, good to know. As far as you've also talked about deep drilling, doing some more deep drilling, is that on the cards this year? Should we be seeing some more of that in 2024?
Yeah, we've done a little bit of deep drilling. Recently returned a hole that got well over a kilometre at 0.2% copper equivalent, which isn't an underground type grade, but it's... It tells us the system's alive and well at depth, and all of our drilling is suggesting that the grades are getting higher at depth. We're encouraged. Well, I was the chief geologist at Cadia in New South Wales, now one of Australia's largest underground mines. Right. And we started with a 13-year pit, and 30 years later they've got 30 years. So these systems can grow. Over at Ayu Tolgoi, it started out as a sort of an open pit situation, and then they were able to discover an ore body called Hugo Dummett, which I think was 300 million tonnes at a percent, sitting well below their pits, which is the current deposit that's being developed and mined by the underground. So we invoked that model that there's potential, serious potential at depth. To fund more deep drilling requires the JV to approve it. I've got no doubt that there'll be deep drilling in the next phase of the project development through 25. We're certainly their geos are quite excited by the possibility, and I think are leveraging off our knowledge of these systems to gain that understanding. So there's no deep drilling planned, no further deep drilling planned at Hamagtai for this year. We're focused on getting the PFS done and the funding negotiated for next year, but I've got no doubt there'll be deep drilling next year.
Oh, that's good to know. As far as the cash goes in the company, how much cash have you guys got at the moment?
Just put our quarterly out. We had about $12 million left in US in the project. This year we'll basically see that $35 million depleted. Therefore, the funding of the project does need to be revisited soon.
Right.
In the top go, we've got about $7 million Aussie at the moment, and for the last year, our G&A has been buffered significantly by the project. So, more than half of our overheads go into the project at the moment. We are doing a little bit of work at our second project, Red Mountain, at the moment, a $1.4 million drilling program for 5,000 metres underway there. So we are doing a little bit outside of Hamagtai. We've also signed a deal on a nickel-copper magmatic system up in the northwest, which will be low cost. We need to get there when snow melts and do boots on the ground type work. We're well funded at the moment. We're not come raise or anything like that under current plans.
And the other two projects you've got, Red Mountain and this new nickel copper project, those are 100% yours, or have you got JVs with those as well?
Red Mountain's 100%. It formerly was a JV with JOGMEC, which is sort of the Japanese state-owned enterprise. They pulled out of just about everything during COVID, so we got $3 or $4 million worth of data for free there. We're drilling there now. That is 100% ours. Sant Tolgoi, the nickel copper system, we have the right to earn up to 80% of that one. $1 million in the first 2 years, boots on ground, make a discovery basically, and then I think the terms are we can earn up to 80% by spending $10 million on a drill out and a PEA. There's deals like that can be done up in Mongolia.
So in terms of the rest of the year, it's amazing that we're in May already. It seems like this year's flying by. What can we expect? The PFS, obviously. Anything else that we should be looking for?
Yeah, listen, in the current quarter, we'll start to see this PFS come together, so there'll be some news flow out of that, and there'll be exploration results from Red Mountain coming through. In the September quarter, you'll see the PFS numbers, the actual physicals and financials around this with a maiden ore reserve. And then I would suspect in the December quarter there will be some sort of deal flow news on the future funding of this project. My impression from everything the Jin say and do is that they're in a hurry to get this thing moving. So I'm not anticipating a period where the project stalls while people fiddle their thumbs. I think there's some serious momentum to get this thing moving.
And do you think there's a danger, they've got 19% at the moment, is there a danger they just come in and say, we'll bid for the whole company, take the whole thing, just lock, stock and two smoking barrels?
I think that's always a danger. I mean, they've positioned themselves as our biggest shareholder for a reason. My impression is it wouldn't be hostile. I think that they're very conscious in the mining. The mining world's small, and after some early missteps, I think they're very keen to maintain their reputation. I would anticipate if that happens, it'll happen in a more friendly way. But you know, anything's possible, of course.
Now, we are, of course, seeing a little bit of consolidation in the mining space at the moment, not least of which, I guess, is the BHP tilt at Anglo. Any thoughts on that? Is that likely to happen, or is there going to be more consolidation from other players as well? Glencore's been mentioned as a potential buyer as well as BHP for Anglo. So are we going to see more of this happening?
Oh, listen, I think so. I mean, that just comes full circle to where we started. I mean... Yeah. BHP are obviously long on copper, and they see Anglo as a natural acquisition for them. And I did also read today that Glencore might be in there as a third party. Yeah. So control of the world's large copper deposits is clearly on the agenda of the big boys. I'm on the board of a smaller copper production company in Australia, and. I think that we're seeing a fair bit of M&A activity in the small to mid size as well. Yeah. In both copper and gold, it's obviously happening in gold quite a bit over in the West. So I don't think that's filtered down to the developers yet, but that's a natural progression, isn't it, as we go through this cycle, part of the cycle.
It is a natural progression. From an investor point of view on the ASX, it's getting hard to find pure copper plays after Osmin's disappeared. I mean, we can obviously go to BHP and Rio in the big caps, but they're usually seen as iron ore rather than copper, although that's not really true. But it's hard to find those mid-tier or emerging copper plays, and maybe Xanadu is one of those, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, I think in terms of the pounds of copper we have and our enterprise value per pound of copper, we're pretty cheap. I think the developers are the next group. Mongolia is not for everyone, the copper is where the copper is, and there's no such thing as an easy jurisdiction anymore. I think when it comes to big copper deposits, you need to look at capital intensity and time to production, because if you're not already in development, you're too late.
It's amazing, isn't it? Every time there is a bit of a bull run in copper, I'm always interested to see Bougainville picks up, and the interest there picks up big time. And we've seen that one on a bit of a charge recently. So clearly there's a lot of appetite out there at the moment for copper projects. And with Osmin's gone and only really Samphire in that space left, it's hard, isn't it, to find good quality companies with good quality managements, good quality projects. And Xanadu, I think, is certainly becoming one of those.
Well, absolutely. And some of the projects I've been involved in the past, the Tujubukit copper deposit in Indonesia is controlled by Merdeka, which is a large Indonesian listed company now. Mm. And that's a big deposit, and it's very similar to Wafi Golpu, which Newmont just inherited through Newcrest. Bougainville's an interesting place. I've been there. New Guinea's pretty wild, and Bougainville's even wilder. But if and when they can settle down Bougainville, that's a potentially huge source of copper. So but at the other end of the scale, the world needs companies like Xanadu discovering copper deposits, so that we can get them into the hands of a company that's positioned to build and operate those mines, not only profitably but also to a very high standard. And I think what Hamagtai will be is a contemporary, high quality, high standard mine that any major would be happy to loan.
And you're based in Melbourne, Colin. So how often do you get up to Mongolia?
I've been twice this year already. The first time it was minus 38 degrees Celsius, which was interesting.
Wow, minus 38.
It was what they call a zud. It's a once in every 10 or 20 years that it's so cold that the ground freezes and the stock have trouble with feed.
Yeah.
So we were able to help out our neighbours with some stock feed down there. But yeah, really, really seriously cold winter. It's come good now. I was there the other day and I was in shirt sleeves at 19 degrees or something. So,
oh, wow, that's a massive, massive volatility of temperature.
I'll get there a couple more times this year as things heat up. They have a big Mongolian mining week in August, which is worth coming to.
Yeah.
And that's where you hear about from everybody about where Mongolia is heading as a country. And it's a terrific place. I mean, you go north of Ulaanbaatar, it's lakes and mountains and fishing and hunting, and it's a beautiful country.
Yeah.
Down south, you get into the South Gobi very, very quickly. And the government is really encouraging development down there. And they've done a lot of work on infrastructure. There's sealed roads, there's power, there's water, there's rail. It's as a guy, I've spent a lot of time, trying to develop deposits in Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. It's a delight to have all that sort of infrastructure at your doorstep, and technically a very straightforward project to manage.
And a relatively stable political system up there as well?
Yeah, they're a young democracy. It's only 30-odd years since the Berlin Wall came down, and the current ruling party is on their second term, and I think there's an election shortly, and it looks like they'll probably get back in. So, you've got a fairly stable political environment. They're the first to admit they made some mistakes, early on, but I think they're working in the right direction pretty rapidly.
Mm. I think all young democracies do. In fact, I think even old democracies do. We're seeing that play out in not only in our own, but the UK, the US, across Europe as well. So they're not Robinson Crusoe in that respect, are they?
Absolutely. I think the younger generation in Mongolia, a lot of them are educated overseas now, so they're becoming a lot more worldly very quickly. Terrific people. They're fiercely independent. Don't call them Russian and don't call them Chinese. They're Mongolian.
Well, that's good. Colin, it's been an absolute delight chatting to you today about Xanadu. It's an exciting new project for you guys and an exciting new opportunity, I guess, for investors to get in to a copper project in a pretty interesting region. And of course, you've got the Rio Tinto factor as well at play up there. So congratulations on getting it this far. I'm really looking forward to seeing the PFS later this year, and we'll be following it with immense interest.
Thanks very much, Henry. I've enjoyed talking to you.
It's been great. Thank you, Colin.